Good morning. It is morning huddle time. Chad Prinky. I am here solo today because Stacy is struggling to get caught. I have a theory that the Eagles won the Super Bowl and she's still partying. That's my current theory. I believe that's still happening in Stacy's world. I'm joining you live from a hotel room in Middle America. Happy to see everybody here this morning. And if for those of you who are catching up live, or, you know, and on the recorded version, we want to remind you that we do go live at 9 a.m. Eastern every Tuesday morning. Be happy to see you here so that you can engage and interact with questions when we have our guests on. I wanted to just start off today briefly by sharing a client success story. One of the things that I don't spend a lot of time talking about, and I think Stacy and I both, there are folks who are like, is podcasting your full-time gig? And the answer is no, it is not. It is not our full-time gig. This is a piece of what we do. And one of the things that I get the great opportunity to be a part of is helping construction companies to build more profitable, better places to work that create happier customers. And one success story recently that I wanted to pass along for those of you who are seeking inspiration and thinking about what can you do to be a better place to work. There's a general contractor that I've been working with for 3.5-4 years. And over the course of that time, they've grown exponentially. They've gone from 50 million to about 180 million over that course of time. And they have a steady stream of backlog looking like, 200 million this year and should be already, we can see about 210, 220 into next year. So that growth has been sustainable. And the growth is a part of the success story for sure. But the biggest thing that I wanted to pass along is this is a company that made a hard decision early on in our work together to say, you know what, we want to set a certain kind of culture in our company. And we want to be the place where people who want to work hard have the most fun. And if you're not able to work at that level and that pace, we're just not going to create a space for those people. And that's scary, right? Because you have to make this decision, that there are going to be people you decide aren't going to be a part of your future. And some of those people are your friends. They've been there a long time. And they self-select out by establishing a bar and saying, folks, this is what performing here looks like. And I remember the first time that somebody was failing to meet the threshold and the fear that came associated with that should we honestly uphold this standard and tell this person, look, here's the bar and you're below it. And if you can't meet it, you got to go. And that was a scary interaction, but a courageous interaction. And that did lead to the departure of first one. And then it ended up being about 4 or 5 people over the first year. And over that next year, it was more pressure for sure on the people who had to shoulder that burden. But what happened was people really appreciated the fact that there was absolutely nobody who was a part of the team who was not committed to the same standard of excellence and the same level of work and effort. And over the next few years, they were able to hire and staff with people who fit that mentality, fit that culture. And today, this is what's crazy, is they've managed to achieve that growth by adding only 2 or 3 people net to their headcount from the start. And I pass that along to you to share that, perhaps as you're thinking about your business and your strategic business plan, maybe there's an opportunity for you to do more with less, but better. And they've certainly been able to do it. And their employee engagement scores are absolutely through the roof. People are really happy with where they work. They're working hard, but they feel appreciated. And I think there's several takeaways in there. But one of the things that I wanted to draw a specific point on is the idea that you can't afford to surround your best people with people who aren't giving their best. And when you have the courage to create an environment where we say, you know what, we all have to play at this level, and we're not going to allow certain people to carry the majority and everybody else to, you know, to drag down that bar. It's actually a big thank you to the people who work hard, and they are super appreciative of the fact that there's no double standard remaining in the business. Some food for thought if you're in a position to think through that. I want to introduce our guest today. His name is Stan Stoll. Stan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chad. I love the introduction too.
Good, man. Yeah, cool. I think, you know, usually Stacy and I talk about the world and things like that, but I figured today, with it being just you and I would take the opportunity to share something with the audience that it's really what I do on a day-to-day basis. And I know, as the chief executive officer of Not Labs, or Not Laboratory, sorry, I'm sure you have your fair experience with people and culture and those types of things. I would actually be interested in hearing about that, but I'll do a quick introduction. So Not Labs is a group of forensic engineers who are passionate about using science and engineering to determine how and why failure occurred. And we're going to talk today about structural failures in buildings. And Stan is a forensic engineer. So I know what an engineer does. An engineer designs, and I can imagine what a forensic engineer does, Stan. But why don't you tell our audience what exactly is forensic engineering?
Yeah, forensic engineering generally is after the fact something has gone wrong, right? And so now we're going back in and looking at that. And, you know, unfortunately, it can be part of the nastiness of the litigious world that we live in, or part of the insurance claim process, right? So, you know, attorneys, insurance contractors all want to know what happened, and then they want to know that, then they can decide, you know, okay, how do we fix it? And then two, you know, unfortunately, if there's substantial costs in this, then who needs to pay those bills and things like that? So unfortunately, it can be kind of nasty in that perspective, but I'll share some, there will be some highlights that I'll try to give your audience here as we get in. So
accountability is a thing. This is business, you know, when mistakes are made and massive money is on the line, there is somebody that needs to shoulder that responsibility. And it's not fair that should roll up to the wrong people. So I think, you know, in the pursuit of what is fair and what is right, you are often going to not make people happy. But I also appreciate that cannot be, you know, that can maybe sometimes not be your favorite part of the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can be the most loved person on the job site or in a situation like that, and we can be the most hated person, right? Just in, you know, depending on the circumstances and what went wrong. But Chad, real quick, just on your introduction, you're absolutely right on the culture stuff. Absolutely right. Like, that has been something that my business partner and I, we bought our company in 2020. And that is something that we put tremendous focus on, was the culture of the organization. And right now our leadership group is going through a book called Radical Candor. And it says it, right? It says it right in the title. Like, it is just speak the truth, speak critically to your team, and hold that accountability and so forth. And you're all going to be on the same page, you know, pushing in the same direction. And some team members aren't going to fit that mold, just like your example, but you're developing an organization that is all headed in the same direction. And so you got to kind of have that direction all narrowed in and moving in that direction. So I love your introduction. So just wanted to add that.
I would have at least $1,000 if I had a dollar for every time I told somebody to read Radical Candor. I love hearing that's something that you've made a decision to weave into your business. I think there's never a wrong time to deal with the truth. And sometimes you're not doing anybody any favors by holding back and not saying what really needs to be said to each other. Right. And so, yeah, that is definitely a part of the story of the success story that I shared, is that, you know, this company stopped just being nice and allowing people to, because they realized that wasn't actually being nice to the organization. It's actually being quite cruel to the rest of the organization if you're not really dealing with the truth. So I applaud you for doing that. How many folks do you guys have?
We have about 50 staff members. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Clear is kind, I think, is one of the basis that we've kind of gotten narrowed down to, right? Like, just speak what we need to and speak it candidly. So
That's right. And demonstrate that you care about each other and you know, all that kind of stuff along the way. But we have a shared mission here, right?
Exactly.
There's we could devolve into that whole conversation. I would love that for a separate conversation sometime, Stan. So in this work, and it's actually funny enough, there's actually an interesting tie into your business, because getting to the truth is what you do, right? Getting to the truth of what happened. Why do we have this failure? What occurred? And the facts are just simply going to be the facts in this situation. And that's going to point to what's happening. So, or, you know, to what we should do now. So what are, in your experiences, what are the most common failures that you come across, and what are the most common causes of those failures?
Yeah. So I want to speak to the most common, because our company was founded off of the Hyatt Regency collapse in 1982. Those are one-offs, right? So not those are not your normal stuff. The normal stuff is moisture intrusion, differential movement of buildings, and moisture intrusion can be at the roofing level, building envelope level. We have complex buildings now. And so that's normally where I'm talking about. We also deal with moisture intrusion, ground level grading and drainage, and then like underground parking structures and things like that, where we've got moisture intrusion. And then it would be like foundation movement issues, you know, between Colorado and Texas, where we're largely based, you know, I mean, fantastic soils for causing problems, and having to deal with those situations. And so between moisture intrusion and foundation movement, those would be the most common deficiencies or issues that are provoking problems for contractors.
Okay. And you know, the large majority of our audience are contractors. And so, you know, they're feeling that pain, you know, they're experiencing those issues. And in your experience, when you've gotten right down to it, what are the most common root causes for these issues?
Yeah. So moisture intrusion is associated with going fast and maybe not getting complete clarification on RFIs and things like that in the design documents. Mm. So think about our building envelopes. We are, you know, the Romans built by bulk rock, right? You just stack it up. And frankly, if there was a problem, there was so much redundancy in the system that it never came to fruition. It never caused anything. Now we're building, you know, thin buildings with, you know, these complex insulation systems, you know, with overlaps of various flashings and components like that. And all of those, you know, when you get down into the architectural drawings, those are very nitty gritty on exactly how those need to lap over the top. And normally, I would say, you know, most times those are caught in the design documents. But what happens when we transition and there's not exactly a detail around the corner, and there's another, you know, there's another system coming into play, there's another roofing plane coming in, or whatever, the joists run perpendicular rather than parallel in this area. And so it's what happens around the corner, and is that same sequence of construction the proper sequence in that area? And so it's kind of in those void spaces where the architect or the contractor or the subcontractor doesn't catch that there's a change here. We need to bring this up to the architect or whatever. It's not detected in that area. Like that's one of the big things that I think happens with building envelope failures.
So I'm gonna talk about that in a little bit more detail. So we're going fast. Right. It needs to be just so, because there's we don't have this you know, big, bulky, over-engineered design. We're trying to be efficient with the design, conserve materials, you know, all those types of things. And therefore, what we're designing has to be perfectly implemented. And what you're describing is a contractor doesn't maybe catch something. ask, you know, send in the RFI for clarification, and they install what they kind of inferred.
Yeah, yeah. And nobody's doing anything intentional in these areas. It's just a matter of, oh, we were doing it just like this on this side of the building. We come around here and we continue the exact same thing. Either the detail wasn't called out on the drawings or whatever. And that finesse that happened on the north side of the building doesn't happen on the east side of the building. And we don't have a ton of redundancy in our systems. Like, you know, you've got your exterior, you know, rain screen, and then you've got underlayments of, you know, Tyvek or whatever we're using for WRBs. And if any of those get breached or a combination of errors happen in those areas, you know, the other thing, it would be like EPDM roofing membranes or like decks, you know, where you're using those on a lot of decks, and then those transition into those. Those are complex areas where you're trying to keep moisture out. And we're relying on those WRBs and things like that to catch the moisture in a lot of circumstances, right? Like the exterior skin is not catching everything. So it's getting those details correct on the bottom side, and they can be complicated. You know, our buildings, we don't build rectangles, right? We build pretty buildings, and, you know, they got depth and perception and things like that to them. So they end up being complex in that flashing area.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. And so the, what, I know we've got, we're going fast.
Right.
What should be done? Like, if you were giving advice to the contractors who are doing those installs, what advice would you give them that would help with prevention?
Yeah, just step back. I mean, it does not take much. It's not rocket science. People will figure this out, but just step back. Spend 5 to 10 minutes early in the day thinking about, okay, everything's going up on, you know, all of these sequences are going up. Where is it different? Where is it, you know, where do the details change? Where do those details interlock, right? From one cut section to the next. And then how the heck am I going to do that, right? That's, unfortunately, contractors get put in that place where they have to figure out, you know, clear detail on wall on the north elevation, clear detail on the west, but how do you make those things mesh together right at the corner, right? Yeah. Where you've got two different things. So just step back in that early morning, you know, phase, think about the sequence of construction, think what's changing in your implementation of those details.
Makes sense. And statistically, when it comes to the moisture intrusion issue, which is what we've been talking about, what's been your experience as the forensic engineer? What's been your experience? In terms of who catches, who's ultimately responsible? If you were to look at the design side versus the construction side, what's the percentage split in what you've seen?
Well, I would split that a third, a third, a third. Just, and that's rough, but subcontractor, general contractor, and designers, right? Mm-hmm. Because all parties are probably going to be involved in that. You know, keep in mind, like, the general notes on architectural plans and things like that, and then specifications, right? You know, designers are putting in the plans, that the requirement to understand the specification from the manufacturer, right? And there's a lot out there. This comes back to the complexity of the materials that we're using. The materials that, you know, think about thermal expansion and contraction that's required on, you know, metal siding or something like that. There's nitty gritties down in there on the application of it, that if we miss something, now we're, you know, stretching and we're pulling something loose underneath, or we're pushing into another component. That's why I say it's just complex, right? So the specifications, those have details, those have little hidden nuggets in it that contractors need to be aware of. They want to rely on their suppliers, who are hopefully more closely tied to that specific material and knowing the nuances of that installation. But the general contractor is also responsible for tying those things together between trades, right? Like, you know, who's coming through, how are we sequencing this construction? And so that's where general contractors will kind of get themselves in trouble, is is not catching that, the change in the sequencing of things that need to happen in this area because of whatever, you know, whatever material requirements exist. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, there's kind of several things there.
Yeah, no, and is it common that one of these defects just kind of hits everybody? It's like, all right, everybody's got some ownership here.
Yeah, I mean, tendency, I mean, you'll see. So what happens in the forensic side, you know, or in litigation is there becomes an allocation of damages report. And so that's somebody that's going through from a cost perspective. It can be contractors, you know, that are working in this field, but they're going through and they're saying, okay, here's all the things that went wrong. You know, forensic engineer has a design, forensic engineer, forensic architect has said, this is what went wrong. Here's your root cause. Then the allocation reports come through. And those are the ones that are saying, okay, general contractor is responsible for 10% of this. Subcontractor is responsible for 40% of this. Design professional is responsible for 60%, 30%, whatever, on those. And so, yeah, it ebbs and flows just based on those circumstances. And those are, so that's another, you know, kind of field that sits around ours is these allocation reports that assign those responsibilities. But it's hard to get out of everything 100% unless you just flat don't touch it, you know. And as general contractors, generally general contractors, they're the captain of the ship. Like that's the importance and the value that they're bringing to the projects is to bring all of these, you know, sailors in line and get the, you know, the final product built per the specs. So
cool. Yep. So let's shift gears to the foundation movement issue when we have those issues. Talk about what causes those and you know, same line of questions, who's normally at fault.
Yeah, so foundation issues, I mean, expansive soils are probably our biggest problem, at least here in the two areas where we have large market share, Colorado and Texas. And it's buildings don't go down. People are used to buildings going down. It's kind of unthinkable that buildings rise. That seems complex and seems
right.
But I was just talking here just recently with a geotech on a project, and expansive soils put more pressure on the building than I could put in any other capacity. Snow load, hurricanes, seismic, the soils just when they get wet, and it's kind of a slow movement, but you know, over a couple of days, they'll just put substantial pressures on buildings. We can't, if it's not designed or there's a missing detail in there that doesn't get caught, we can't, the building's going, the building is so light relative to the pressures that can be generated by expansive soils. So ultimately I'm going to back up one step. It's water. Everything in my world that's caught, every problem in my world, 95, 98% of them is water, whether it's that moisture intrusion in the building envelope, or it's moisture getting into the soils and causing them to swell and heave. Yeah. And so the cause of that can be grading and drainage, keeping that water away, gutter downspouts, getting those under, a broken underground drain if we've got something like that that fails. And you know, you're putting underground drains under the ground and then the soils move. Well, that can rupture those underground drains. Now you've got a deluge of water coming off the roofs and all the surface area, and you're dumping it right at the problem child, right? Because that fractured right at the edge of the foundation, right where it comes out from the foundation and heads out to wherever it's headed, you know?
Yeah.
Big problem. So water is always our problem with foundation movement. I'll pause there and let you ask the director.
No, that's good. Keep going.
Well, so with foundation movement, with expansive soils, we're designing those. They're becoming, again, not brute force. We're getting more finessed in our approaches. Lots of micropiles here in Western Colorado. Micropiles are fantastic, but now you've got to have the void form and things like that, and you've got to have detached slabs, and you can't. You're anticipating that some of the slabs, exterior slabs, we can't design them that they're not going to move. So we're going to anticipate that they are going to move. And if they do, we're going to throw them away. That's way cheaper for the owner than to try to design it not to move. So, but you have to account for that movement. Well, you know, building code wants us to have, you know, our clearances, our minimum clearances on between slabs, exterior slabs, and you know, exterior finish materials, so that when those do move, they don't come up and they blow off the stone veneer or whatever's coming up. That would be one of the common things that happens to us, and one of those early indicators that things are moving. And we've watched you know, a lot of, depending on the part of the country, you know, it used to be the standard to dowel concrete slabs into foundations, right? If it settles, like, that'll keep it nice and level. We don't have any trip hazards, anything like that. You do that with expansive soils present, and those dowels dowel into the side of the foundation will blow the top of the foundation out. They'll break the foundation apart. Like, that's how much pressure we're dealing with. So just a common, this is how we've always done it, and thinking about it from the perspective of preventing settlement in the situation with expansive soils, it can be huge, huge problems. Now you just broke the structural foundation.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay. So I'm listening to you go through this, and I'm thinking the exact same pattern is probably happening here. Does it boil down to slow down, pay attention to your details? You know, is it the same piece of advice, or is there anything unique about this?
Yeah, it's the same piece of advice. It's slow down, think about it. I think that you can also spend some time, you know, any of your listeners that are listening to podcasts trying to absorb and take in more information and get better, like, fantastic. Because what I would apply to that situation is micropiles came around in the past 20 years, you know, 15 years in Western Colorado as the solution. But it took 15 years. Well, we're still seeing mistakes being made, right? And it doesn't take that much effort. It's minor details that are causing the problems. But have the conversations with the engineers and educate yourself on, hey, how did you design this? Where is this actually, where's the slip mechanism that's going to allow the sleeve to slide on this micropile when the soil comes up? Understand that part of it. Have that conversation. Ask the geotech, ask the structural engineer, what is happening here? Because when you understand what they are trying to accomplish on paper, you're going to be so much better able to be a problem solver than just along for the ride, just implementing what the engineer designed, right? And that communication doesn't happen in many of the, you know, these are whatever, single family homes and things like that, but, you know, $1, $2 million homes that are blowing off their foundations, no slouch. So
yeah, no kidding. So you just opened the door to something that I feel like is, you know, at the heart of what I deal with. So what I do, just for context, Dan, is I deal with the people and strategy side of construction. Okay. Right. Yep. And if there is one overriding need for improvement that every contractor, even they know, this is a need for improvement company wide, always, it is the need for improved communication.
Yeah.
So opening that door for communication, there's communicating with each other. There's communicating with suppliers and your design partners and your customers and, you know, all that type of stuff. And what I see is this, for various reasons, reluctance to communicate, that's on one hand, just poor communication practices in general on the other hand. How often do you kind of spot that communication is, you know, was a breakdown in all of this stuff?
A huge percentage, 80-90% of the time. Yeah. Right. And if I can tell a little story on this, on a recent situation. So things, this is a construction project. It's a single family residence, high end single family residence. And going through it, the geotechnical engineer didn't realize that this had a basement, and he goes out to do his testing on the micropiles. And that's the first time that he sees that. What? You didn't tell me there's a basement, right? So anyhow, this turns out to be a big deal because the lateral soil pressure, now you've got lateral expansive pressures on the foundation walls from those expansive soils, not just upheave. And so he was not taking that into account when he was providing the geotechnical report on this. So where that went in relative to the conversation, so the contractor the owner, the structural engineer, and the geotechnical engineer all end up out on site looking down at this excavation site where the micropiles are already installed and saying, okay, now what? What concerns do you have? What concerns do you have? What concerns do you have? And all having a communication, all discussing this right there in front of the owner, right? And the biggest value of this was, there's two things. One is the general contractor got to ask all of his questions to the engineers on site in front of the owners, right? And say, okay, now how do we deal with this? How do we, you know, adopt and whatever? That's fine. We figured out ways to deal with the situation. The other key component to this, way too many times, is you want the owner to be aware of the situation. You need them to make the decision. The advisors to owners, right? It's our recommendation. We're stamping these plans and all that stuff, but there's decision points along the way. Do you do a shallow foundation or do you do a micropile foundation? What are the risks of both? It's our jobs as design professionals to provide the contractor and the owner with the risks associated with those. And then there's economics involved with that. So the owner needs to make that. And that's one of the biggest things that I try to communicate to contractors is, hey, if you're making the decision, you own it, right? So if you choose the cheaper chicken for, you know, the foundation or whatever, and it moves, you're going to own that mistake, own that decision, whatever.
That's right.
Repercussion of that decision. So have that conversation with the owners and let them, it's their money, right? Let them decide granite countertops or micropile foundation, right? Like those are, you know what I mean? Like there's economics. Like how risky do you want to build this? Like don't get in a situation. That's probably the biggest thing that I wanted to, for your audience, just understanding your audience is, have the owners make those decisions, educate them, let them ask questions. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to draw out the answers that you want as well. If they're asking questions and understand it, and then they can make decisions off of that.
Yeah. And this, you know, in the commercial construction environment, which is largely where I operate, right? Some of our clients touch residential, but it's not common for us. Yep. But what I watch are well-meaning, hardworking general contractors who have, I think it's a balancing act, how much they want to pull their owner into conversations. It is very, very common that the subcontractor will never interact in any forum where the owner is present. Sure. Right. And the general contractor, God love them, doesn't know what that trade contractor specialist knows about that individual trade. And there's just so much damned inefficiency in that process.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, maybe there's this. I completely agree with your assessment. Stop hiding information from owners. Stop trying to make decisions for owners that really are owner decisions. Get really good at engaging your owners in conversations, educating your owners. It's okay to guide and recommend, right? So if that's great, but make sure that your owner has all the information and that they are the decision maker. Because if you become the decision maker on something that the owner didn't get an opportunity to weigh in on, you just absorb that risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And that will show up in the litigation.
That's right.
It's the same, and at its simplest form, you chose the cheaper chicken, and therefore you chose more risk for whoever owns that product into the future, right?
That's right.
So,
and it's interesting because when I asked, you know, where does the risk typically fall, and you sort of said, no, I gave you a designer versus contractor, and so that was probably unfair, but you didn't mention owners, and the reason that I call that out is only to say that more often than not, we have absorbed that risk unnecessarily because we didn't get the owner involved.
Yeah. Yeah, because owners, you know, when problems arise, they're generally not associated with making a decision point that would provoke them to be responsible, right? So you're right. You don't see a lot of owners. Now, at least maybe, well, if it's an owner responsibility, you don't get sued. Everything dies. They realize it's their own responsibility early on and, oh, well, okay, how do we fix it? But if it's not their responsibility, you know, their attorney's on their first call and everything rolls downhill for anything that can be responsible for by the contractor, right?
Yeah, 100%. So, while we could, there are things that you don't have to change structurally to improve communication. You can just simply say like, hey, let's break down some of these silos. Let's stop. You know, it's amazing to me. Again, these well-meaning general contractors, I oftentimes are preventing the subcontractor from even talking to the engineer, let alone the owner. And I'm like, what are you doing, man? Look, you can be a part of that conversation, but you have got to make sure that they've got an open line of communication to the design community. You can't be this roadblock. You've got to be a bridge builder and a communication encourage. You've got to be the chief collaborator, not trying to protect silos and things along those lines. Yeah, that doesn't require any structural change. That just requires making that decision as a company and saying, we're going to be this type of company that's more collaborative and we're going to train all of our PMs and superintendents and so on to think about the whole project team and pull people into the appropriate discussions. We are the connectors in chief, right? Like that's a cultural move.
Absolutely. And we end up doing a lot of post-litigation repairs. So it's something's gone wrong. It went through litigation. We may or may not have been associated with that, whatever. Now they're going back in to fix the problems that were discovered during that process. Yeah. Some of our best contractors that we're working with in that situation will have weekly OECs, owner engineer contractor meetings, yep. Right? They're forcing that. And you got to think about somebody's already been sued over issues. You're really trying to correct these things, but that is exactly what they're doing is they're providing they're creating that opportunity for communicating with the owner engineers and whatever. They're putting everybody in the same room and saying, and they're kind of dealing with the circumstances that are dealt. Engineer brings up a problem. Well, let's discuss it. You get it out in the open. I guarantee that helps this contractor prevent liability on theirs because, well, we all made this decision as a group. If anything were to ever go wrong, you know, and that I see it mostly in the post-litigation repair side of things, but I'd encourage it, you know, as a useful tool on the other side.
So I find that there normally are OAC meetings and that those meetings are either weekly or biweekly. I see that stuff happening, but I have sat in on, I don't know, 5 dozen OAC meetings over the course of my, 20 years doing this work. And they suck. Those meetings suck. They don't know. They're super checklist, just kind of check the box. The owner's like sitting on his phone the whole time, looking up like, you just tell me what I need to chime in on, right? It's one thing to hold the meeting. It's another thing to hold that meeting really effectively. And I think, maybe different episode, different time. Maybe I'll run something on how to run a not shitty OAC meeting. But I wonder if you have any input from what you've seen on best practices for running an effective OAC.
Just agenda and setting that up for why are you doing this? And if you inform the owner about why you're doing this, you want them to be a part of this and you explain to them that, hey, we're going to make decisions. If you're not here, we're making our best decisions for you, but we'd prefer you to be a part of this or require you to be a part of the decision-making process. You're the ultimate, you're the ultimate judge on this project. Like we're advisors to you. You help us make these decisions along the way at critical components, right? Like, I know, like stay out of the weeds when things are just rolling and so forth. But if you can kind of set that expectation of what you need from owners, that might help.
I think that's great advice. So often we get into a routine, we're just kind of doing it because we've always done it and yada, yada. And if we started off every OAC meeting by saying, hey guys, just a reminder, the purpose of this meeting is to, you know, get decision, you know, to provide critical updates where people need to be informed, to share issues and discuss those issues, and chiefly to make decisions as a collective team, with you as the owner being the driver of this bus. You know, we are counting on you for key input. So with that in mind, here's the updates on the stuff that's going on. Here's the here are the problems that we need to address. And here today, here are the three decisions we need to make, you know, type of thing. That could, that would be a much more effective type conversation.
It goes right back to your communication, Chad. Like, the better we are at communicating, the better the overall project's going to go. So, yes.
So, which naturally then leads to the last thing I want to talk to you about while we're together is this idea that there are, yes, so you don't have to do anything different or special. Just make a decision to be a better communicating team. That's something that's within all of our grasp, and you have to, you know, set standards and live by those standards. But there are also delivery methods that are specifically designed to help us as a team, to kind of force us as a team into being a more collaborative unit. I know you recently wrote an article about design build. Take a moment and talk about what you view as the benefits or drawbacks, if you will, depending to selecting design build when it comes to building a better quality product at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that in a design build capacity, like the benefits are contractors get to come to the table earlier on in the process and have an opinion on material selection and many of these things that are going to help with the overall product and how it's built. There's great benefit to having the contractor's knowledge base pulled into that early phase. Like, absolutely. But at the end of the day, no matter how the design comes to be, the failures are going to happen in the intricacies, because most of those things that I was talking about are not, you'll pick up some foundation things. You'll pick up like, oh, hey, this is critical to separate, you know, flat work from foundation elements or whatever. You'll understand, you'll pick up some of those things, but the nitty gritty is going to come down to the implementation things, like on building facades and stuff like that, building envelopes that I was talking about earlier. That's where the issues are going to come into play. So I'm all for pulling contractors in earlier and pulling them into the design phase of the project. That'll make a better product, but ultimately the implementation process is a bigger component to a successful project than the design build or however we're coming to develop the project.
So benefits, but not a cure all.
I don't think so. Right. Right.
Yeah. And that's what I'm seeing out there too. You're at the end of the day, funny enough, man, totally accidentally, there's a tie back to the beginning of our conversation, several times to the beginning of the episode, my intro, that is, several times today, in that, you know, the far more important piece of this is culture. The far more important piece of this is the actual culture. Yeah. Anyway, all right. Hey, last words.
Well, I did have one, guidance for your audience.
If you may.
I've watched this and sat through a few of these situations where you're going into construction and now all of a sudden you've got a dispute with the engineering team and, you know, whatever. So I'll talk as an example. So this is a big community building, like a four-story building. And all of a sudden during construction, there's like eight of these buildings going up. During construction, the first ones start to develop these cracks in them. And the engineer comes in and devises, they say that the roof trusses are sagging and they're creating these overloading things and causing this cracking. And the contractor was a little skeptical of this. This is a pretty good sized GC and a little skeptical, but okay. And so they designed this $500,000 solution. They point at the general contractor and say, look, you messed up. These trusses are deflecting. This is your fault. All this stuff. And so they designed a $500,000 fix to notch all these top plates in there to allow these trusses to deflect, right? Okay, so fast forward 8 months, a year. Then they do that, the buildings are still cracking. This contractor is losing his mind at his design team on this, right? So here's my pitch, and it's not for us, but just think outside the box on this. your what we did in that situation, general contractor brought us in. They just wanted another set of eyes. Come sit in this room as a GC representative. Listen to the logic of these other engineers that they're giving us, because they're all trying to solve this problem. The owner's having a conniption over this issue.
Totally.
And so we sit in it, and it turns out it's really quick to look at it. And they had gotten so focused on this issue that was happening at the roof level and causing these cracks, but they're happening on level 3 and 2 and 1. Like, what? Really? So as we go through it, it took a simple level on the floor at the slab to go, the slab is settling at the center. Your $500,000 fix that you implemented was worthless, right? But anyhow, and I've worked through a few situations where you get into a dispute or a situation where the engineer may not be right on it. And then the other one was where material suppliers come in and they're saying, this one happened to be the expansion contraction stuff. And they're saying, you screwed up. This doesn't work. And contractors get stuck with that because manufacturers have engineers on staff and whatever. They'll beat you up with knowledge and all this testing and research and all that stuff. In this situation, in both of those situations, the contractor was right. Like, yeah. But they needed somebody to come in on their behalf and help them, you know, articulate it in engineering terms and ultimately solve the problem, right? So anyhow, think of forensic engineers as like another tool that you can use. If something arises, we're in the scheme of things, we're pretty cheap to just give me a second set of opinion. You know,
it's anyhow, a pretty affordable insurance policy to prevent you from spending a ton of time and money chasing down, you know, band-aids when there's a real fix out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is when situations arise and you're trying to figure it out and everybody's scratching their head. Like think of forensic. I say forensics just because forensics are going to be dealing with existing buildings and they're going to be detached. We don't have a vested interest. As soon as you flip the switch on that engineer that's on the design team, now all of a sudden they've got a little bit of like redundancy, like, oh, I might be responsible. There's kind of, you know, that type of posturing going on. Get past that, like, you know, kind of pull in some outside just to help. Anyhow, food for thought. It's worked well for a couple situations. So
no, I think it's great. Again, the truth is the truth. And let's figure that out. And sometimes it can be helpful to not place the burden of truth on people who clearly have a personal financial, stake in the matter.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So.
Stan Stoll, folks, thank you very much. Appreciate you joining. Great conversation. Check out Stan. Not Laboratories. Stan, where if people wanted to talk to you, where would they find you?
Yeah, so website's notlab.com, KNOTTLAB.com, and then my email address is sstoll@notlab.com. So happy to connect. So awesome. Thanks, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was awesome having you here. Thank you. Yeah, see you, Stan. Thank you. All right. I want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsors, Sandy Spring Bank, Katz Abosch Accounting, Genesis AEC, Lawrence Law, and the Marsh McLennan Agency. These are 5 different organizations that know what they do inside and out. They support the construction industry, and we really appreciate their support. So Sandy Spring Bank, Katz Abosch, Genesis AEC, Lawrence Law, and Marsh McLennan Agency. I want to talk to you a little bit about what we have coming up next week. We've got the state of the commercial industry. We've got Alex Kablanian joining from Service Titan. Service Titan, if you're not familiar, is a mammoth and really, really successful organization that does software and so many more things now with all the strength that they've been able to create with their product. They really are the gold standard for service contractors. And we're going to be talking about what's happening in the commercial market sector, what happened in 2024, what we're thinking is going to happen in 2025. That should give you some good insight as to what's happening in terms of new starts, renovations, things like that. So very focused conversation with Alex on that topic next week. We hope that you join us. Again, I am Chad Prinke. Thank you for joining us for the Morning Huddle. We'll see you soon.